Where do we start? The first talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by Ron Julian on September 26, 2000 at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I'll tell you where I am going to start. I'm going to start by making just one overall apology right at the very beginning so that we don't have to do this all through the evening. Obviously, I have a cold, and that means that my body is going to force me to do all kinds of disgusting things during this talk, probably. distracting things, unpleasant things, and I'm not going to apologize every time they happen. I'm just going to give one big apology right now. I have my doubts as to whether my brain is actually functioning at this point, so maybe I should apologize for that too, but I won't. I'm going to pretend at any rate like what I say is coherent. And if it turns out that it isn't, I would invite you to come back next week because there will be a different speaker next week and the odds are good he won't be sick. So the odds are good that maybe next week it'll actually make some sense. Okay, this is the beginning of our series on the basic truths of biblical Christianity. And you will see as the series goes along, our focus is really on what is at the heart of biblical Christianity. It's not necessarily, this is not a systematic theology. We're not going to go through and say, okay, what does the Bible say about angels? What does the Bible say about this? It's not that sort of thing. We're trying to get at the basic fundamental questions that the Bible raises and addresses about who we are and who God is and what is our problem and what is the solution to those problems and so on. Tonight is going to be different. You just need to understand that of the 10 talks that we're going to be giving, tonight is not like the other 9. Because tonight, what we want to do is ask the question, where do we start? What we want to look at is the approach that we take to the Bible in answering the kinds of questions that we're going to be addressing. This is a series about biblical Christianity, and the question arises, how do we know that the Bible says what it is that we're going to say that it says? The fact is that Christians disagree greatly about the Bible and what its message is. I don't know if that's a shocking statement to you. Maybe you're at a spot where you say, oh, I know that's true. I hear people saying all kinds of things. Or maybe from your background, maybe you have the idea that, hey, well, Christians all agree on things. That's what makes them Christians. We believe what the Bible says. Let me just tell you, at this point in my life, having talked to a lot of Christians, read a lot of things, heard a lot of things, there is hardly anything that Christians ultimately agree on, if you take Christians as a whole. People who would believe that Jesus is the Christ will disagree about just about everything else, including what it means that Jesus is the Christ. Just yesterday, I came across an interesting account. A man was telling about his early upbringing. His father died when he was 1 year old. The reason he died is he was a Christian in a community of Christians. He was ill. He needed an iron lung. But the community of Christians that he was in believed that he would be healed, and he didn't use the iron lung because he was convinced that, you know, he would exercise his faith and God would heal him. Well, God did not heal him and he died because he didn't use the iron lung. The man's mother was very committed to the idea of what she would have called the victorious Christian life. She told her son that she hadn't sinned in 12 years. When her other son, the man's brother, got to be the age of being a teenager, like many teenagers do, he was rebellious and uncooperative, and she said to him, that I never want to see you again. And 30 years later, she still has never spoken to that brother. Well, you might ask the question, what happened to this guy? You would think he'd grow up and say, I don't have anything to do with Christianity, right? I mean, this stuff is awful. Actually, that's not what happened. He ended up staying with the faith, and he's actually a very well-known author. Writes for Christianity Today and has written a number of books. But he has a very different perspective on the faith than the perspective that he grew up in. He sees the Christianity of his parents, the word he would use is it's toxic. He thinks it's so much out of tune with reality that it's like taking poison. Well, the funny thing about this is, though, it's not like he got a new and different Bible when he grew up. He discovered, oh, they were reading this other Bible, and that one didn't have the right information in it, but I got the right Bible, and now I know. They were all reading the same Bible. So how does that happen? How is it that we end up reading the same Bible and we end up with such radically different conclusions? I mean, what's the point of you guys coming here and listening to us talk about biblical Christianity? I can guarantee you that you can go down the street and find somebody else who will give you a different story. They will tell you what biblical Christianity is all about, and it will not be the story that you're going to hear here. So why not just give up on the whole thing? I mean, if we can't seem to agree on what this is about, maybe the Bible doesn't know what it's talking about at all. I mean, what are we supposed to think about this? How can we sort out the truth from the error? You may have heard the expression before, oh, you can use the Bible to say anything. And there is a great deal of truth to that. Almost any idea that you can imagine has been defended from the Bible. In the end, it comes down to this book here. What's going on with this? What sort of a book is this? Does it communicate? Is it possible to know what it is that it says? Why are there so many different opinions about what it says? These are not academic questions to me, although sometimes in order to pursue these questions, we have to talk about academic kinds of things. These have been the life and death kind of issues of my life. When I was a young Christian, I became a Christian at about 18 years old. I was a stone atheist before that time, very proud atheist before that time. I had looked on Christians with a great deal of contempt. When I became a Christian, my first response was, okay, well now I'm a Christian, and so Christians must all understand what this is about. I don't, because I'm just getting started, but presumably everybody knows what this is all about, right? And I started out with the assumption that everything that everybody said was true. I mean, every Christian, every pastor, every radio show, every TV show, every book, they're all basically telling the same story, right? And I'm just going to listen and take it in and figure out what that story is. And after a while, I realized that it was not the same story that was being told, and it made a great deal of difference who was right. I was being told some important things that contradicted each other on some very important issues. Questions about who's saved. You want to know whether or not you are going to inherit eternal life? Does that seem like an important question from the biblical perspective? It seems like an important question to me. And yet, people had radically different answers about who it was that was going to be saved. What about if you're a sinner? What if you look at your life and you say, you know, there are things about my life that are not the way they ought to be? What does that mean about you? Does that mean that you're not saved? Does it mean that if you were saved, you wouldn't be a sinner like that? I got very different answers on that question from the people that I talked to. And those were big questions to me. So what happened in my particular story in life is that those questions drove me to really bang my head on the Bible. Now, not just by myself, but the fact is that it was that uncertainty, those sets of questions with the radically different answers out there that really forced me to have to think about what kind of a book is this and how is it talking. Along the way, I've had some tremendous help. Some of the guys around here, Jack Crabtree, I took a class from him on biblical interpretation back in the middle of the 70s that changed my life, absolutely changed my life. I was really on the road to becoming kind of a cynic about the Bible and about its ability to communicate because of all of these stories out there. And what Jack had to say was so incredibly helpful that it really kind of, in a lot of ways, set the course of the rest of things for me. So what I've been doing for the past 25 years or whatever since that time is myself pursuing, together with some other people, pursuing, trying to understand how does the Bible communicate and what is it it's saying and what implications does it have then for my life. That's what I do. So what I want to do tonight is more theoretical than anything we're going to be doing in any of the other talks. I hope you can bear with that. But I want to talk a little bit just about the hows of this thing. Is it really possible to come to the Bible and have some sort of confidence that we have understood what it's saying? And if it is, how, on what is that confidence based? Okay, I want to start with a story that I made up last year as an illustration. I was answering a question or something, I don't remember. I made up this story and I kind of like it, so I'm going to use it again. You have the privilege, you don't know it now, you're going to die and you're not going to hear anything about it, but hundreds of years from now, there is going to be a religion founded on your letters. People are going to find the letters that you wrote to people and they're going to put them together in a book. You know, it will be the Epistle to Corvallis and all of that kind of stuff. And this religion is going to be founded on the wisdom of your correspondence. So, one of your letters is written to a brother that you have who is going to law school, only he's a real flake. He figured he could skip all his classes and just stay home and watch Perry Mason reruns. And he'd learn enough about law to be able to make it work. So you are not impressed with this, and you write him, and you tell him, you know, I really don't think that that approach is going to work. If you want to succeed, I would think twice. Now, in the context of your letter, of course, it's fairly obvious what you're saying. I want you to reconsider the way you're approaching your studies here. I think you'd better start going to classes or you're not going to make it. But your followers, several hundred years from now, catch a hold of that phrase. They pull it out, if you want to succeed, I would think twice. Okay? We all want to succeed. We want to find success. So, the key to success, according to the wisdom found in your letters, is to think twice. And so there is a ritual that your followers develop where every time you come to do something and you think about the course of action that you're going to take, you stop and you think about it again. So, you know, if I'm going to, you know, whatever it might be, I never think a thought once. I always think it twice. And if I do that, then I will succeed. And if I don't do that, then I only have myself to blame because I was given the technique. I was told, if you think twice, then you're going to succeed. Well, I hope that, I mean this to be really obvious and silly as to what's going on there, but you see what's happened is instead of trying to figure out what it was that you meant in the letter that you wrote to your brother, your letter has turned into a little storehouse of verses, and those verses are being pulled out, and they're being applied without any thought as to what it is you meant when you said it, or what it meant in the context in which you were speaking, but they were just pulled out, and okay, let's run with that. Success. We want success, so let's go with that one. Well, what I'm saying is that silly example is actually very much the way that many of us end up dealing with the Bible. One of the most common mistakes that let me just say, the church at large makes when it comes to dealing with the Bible is we treat it as if it is this kind of a grab bag of rules and promises. And we just sort of reach in and we grab whatever verses seem to apply at the moment and take them and make them fit somehow and try to find a course of action based on those. I don't know how many of you remember, I have never actually known anybody who has done this, but I have been told of some church cultures where people had what they called promise boxes, which is basically you take your Bible and you cut it up, you take verses out, and you take the verses and you stuff them into a box, and then the idea is, you know, each day or something like that, you reach in and you pull out your verse, and that's your promise for the day. And you just hope that you got something that made a little sense. Well, maybe that's not hard to see that that's a pretty strange way to deal with the Bible. But in fact, oftentimes that's really how we end up treating the Bible. That's how I was taught to use the Bible. That's how the people that taught me in my early days as a Christian used the Bible. So, a real silly and obvious example, but this is a real example, this is someone that someone actually did this and commended it to me, as this is how God spoke to them. They were trying to decide, they had an opportunity to move to and get another job that was in another state, or they could stay where they were, and they couldn't decide which to do. And so they read in 1 Corinthians 7:20, "Everyone should remain in the state in which he was called." It's a message from God. We're not supposed to move to another state. We're supposed to stay here. Well, probably most of you here could recognize that's probably not what Paul had in mind when he wrote that. Now, let me give you some other examples, which I'm not going to explain to you, but which all of these are things that have been taught to me in the past. I just want to intrigue you a little bit. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says, "Now if any man builds upon the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire. And the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built upon it remains, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as through fire." And I have been taught many times in my life that that passage teaches that each person is building on the foundation of their faith with either good works or bad works, and that your rewards in heaven, whether you receive rewards or not, depend on the quality of, okay, you have faith and you're going to be saved, but your rewards depend on the quality of the works that you build upon the foundation of your faith. Doesn't it sound like that's what that passage is saying? It sure sounds like that's what the passage is saying. I would argue that is not what that passage is saying. If you go and you look in context and you follow Paul's argument, he's talking about something very different. That is not the subject, even, of what he's talking about there. Here's a very common one. I was taught this a lot. If you confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. And I have been taught many times that you want to know how to be saved? There's the formula. Believe that Jesus rose from the dead and confess it with your mouth. Like, go forward someplace, publicly declare that you believe that. So, believe that Jesus rose from the dead and publicly declare with your mouth that you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and you will be saved. Do you have any question about whether you have been saved? Do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Did you go forward someplace and say it? Then you're saved. I would argue that is not what that passage is teaching. It does not give me the answer to the question that I'm bringing to it. If I were to ask the question, is that all that is required of a human being to be saved? That's not the issue that Paul is addressing, and he's talking about something else. This was a very popular verse when I was in the church that I used to go to years ago. from 2 Corinthians, Paul says, "Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God." This was like the key verse of the church that I used to belong to. And what we were told is, this is like the most important verse in the whole Bible because it gives you the key to success in the Christian life. If you try to do it on your own, you will fail. But if you rely upon the adequacy of God, then you will succeed. And you've heard expressions like "let go and let God" and that sort of thing. And this verse was used to defend that idea, that if I want to have success in my life as a Christian, victory over sin, success in ministry, and that kind of thing, then I need to cast myself upon the adequacy of God. And that's what this verse is teaching. Once again, I would argue that is not what this verse is teaching. It doesn't have anything to say about that at all. That's not even close to what it is Paul's talking about. Now, why am I doing this? I mean, dropping these little things and then leaving them alone. I'm just trying to get your attention a little bit to the kind of thing that I'm talking about. That this idea of pulling verses out of context can be a very subtle thing. It's obvious when we say everyone should remain in the state in which he was called, you're not paying attention to the context. But I would suspect that many of you in the last three examples that I gave, in at least one of them, were saying to yourself, "Wait a minute, what do you mean? That is what those verses are saying, isn't it?" And so, if that's the case, then, if, just for the sake of argument, I'm right in what I just said, then that would indicate that maybe we have got some rethinking to do about this question of what we mean about reading in context. One of the things that I want to argue for here is one of the things that we try to champion around here is that we are on the lookout for the intent of the author. When Paul wrote that to the Corinthians, my overriding concern, first of all, has to be, what did he mean? What did he want them to understand? Not even me. Not what does he want me to understand, because he wasn't writing it to me. He was writing it to them. He was writing it to people who lived 2,000 years ago in a particular situation. Now, is that relevant to me? Yes, it is. It's very relevant to me, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is. But the fact is, I have to start with, this guy, Paul, wrote a letter to them. What did he mean when he wrote to them? That's the question that I bring to the text. So, trying to say it as simply as I can, the approach that we believe in here at the Study Center, as we come to the Bible, is we come to the Bible to read it and figure out what the authors meant to say. Excuse me. When you and I read things, how is it that we figure out what an author intends? I mean, what is it that we're doing? When you pick up anything and read it, what do you do? What's happening? Well, the author expected you to know some things. He expected you to know the language that he was using. If you write a letter to somebody in English, you write it in English because you figure they know English, right? I mean, that's why I'm writing it in English. You're counting on the fact that they know English. You wouldn't even really set out to write it if the person that you were writing to, you knew they don't know any of these words that I'm using. They don't know the grammar. They don't understand how any of this stuff works. What's the point? This whole communication thing depends upon you knowing the same things I know so that I can communicate to you the things that I know and you don't. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but communicating new things to somebody depends on having a whole bunch of stuff that you already know in common. And if you don't have that, then communication can't happen. So, the language, the background. A little while ago, a very small little joke, Epistle to Corvallis. Everybody here laughed. Everybody knows where Corvallis is. I could have said that in a lot of places in the world, and nobody would have laughed. Because To them, Corvallis is even more obscure than Corinth or Galatia or any of the places that Paul was writing to. They probably would stop and ask themselves, Corvallis? Is that one of the books of the Bible? I mean, what? Because they don't know. That's right. That's right. The whole reason that quick little, not very funny joke could have the modicum of humor that it had is because you all know something immediately fast enough that I can count on you using it, and you get what I'm talking about. Well, the biblical authors had that same thing. They talked about the world in which they lived. And unfortunately, you and I don't live in the same world that they do altogether. So we have some work to do. If you and I are going to get in the position where we can understand what Paul was saying to the Corinthians, or what Isaiah was writing to the Jews who were living in Babylon at the time, or no, not Babylon, who were going to be living in Babylon when they read about what it was that he was talking about, then we have to somehow get back in the position of knowing what those people knew. It takes some work. My English Bible here, the translators have done a lot of work for me, and that's great. But sooner or later, if there's a real question that I come up against, I'm going to have to do some work for myself. I may have to look something up. I may have to do some thinking about what exactly did that word mean. And together with those things, and those things that I might have to look up and think about, things that Paul was expecting me to know that I don't know, and so I'm going to have to do some work to recover that knowledge, Paul and any author is expecting that I'm going to read his words in context. I'm going to look for the flow of thought. Just do an experiment sometime. Take somebody's letter and chop it up into verses and sprinkle them all around. And find out what happens to it all. I mean, we don't write that way. Even just casual letters, our ideas flow along. One sentence comes after the other. And if we don't look for that and don't ask ourselves, what's the idea here? What's the topic? What is Paul talking about in this letter? If we don't ask those kinds of questions, then we're going to go away with the wrong idea about what it is the passage is saying. When we have figured out what it says, we have read it to understand what the author meant to say, then we're going to ask ourselves the question, how does that affect my view of the world? Now that I know that Paul said this to the Corinthians, what difference does it make? What have I learned about things from that is going to somehow change or augment or fill in my picture of the way things are? One of the big mistakes that we make in coming to the Bible is treating it as if it's just kind of a set of rules or a set of verses that give us promises or something like that. That's not the kind of book it is. If you go to the Bible and try to treat it that way, maybe you've had this experience. It can be sort of frustrating. I mean, read your way through, you know, 1 Kings, trying to come away with every verse being some sort of a promise or instruction to you from God about what's supposed to happen. It doesn't work. It's not intended to do that. And frankly, you can read something like 1 Kings and come away with very little. I mean, you sort of, what in the world was I supposed to get from that? Why did God want me to read that? I mean, what is it about that that's supposed to do something for me? Well, it's a piece of the puzzle. It's a piece of a bigger story. And what we're trying to do is learn that bigger story. We get a little bit of it here, we get a little bit of it here. And what we're trying to do is get a picture of the world, a picture of the way things are. We're trying to get a picture of God and His character and His purposes. We're trying to get a picture of ourselves. What kind of people are we? What is our problem? What is God doing about that problem? From beginning to end, the Bible is painting a multifaceted picture of reality for us. What we're trying to do is build up that worldview. And then when I have that view of reality, then I can look at my life and start to have some wisdom about what I face and the decisions I make and so on. Very rarely does the Bible just come along and say, do it like this. If you run into this situation, then do this. It's not that it never does. I mean, there are some basic instructions that it gives that are pretty comprehensive and not difficult to apply. But fundamentally, what the Bible is doing for me is showing me God at work in the world, showing me God's encounter with other human beings at a time when He entered into His creation to tell us what He wanted us to know about Himself. So, let me give you an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Unfortunately, the kind of approach that we sometimes bring to the Bible is a lot like the approach that the Pharisees brought to the Bible. The Pharisees were a group of, a party of Jews at the time of the New Testament. They had a particular perspective on Judaism and what it was that God was requiring. And as you may be familiar with, Jesus basically said of the perspective of the Pharisees that they had it all wrong, that they did not understand God, they did not understand what God's purposes were. And he had some pretty strong words for them, actually. So, we have some examples of some encounters between Jesus and the Pharisees. In one situation, the Pharisees try to trip up Jesus, and they asked him a question regarding divorce. And basically, some of the Pharisees used to argue about whether or not divorce was permitted. And those who argued that divorce was permitted would point to a particular verse in Deuteronomy where Moses referred to a man giving his wife a certificate of divorce. And what basically happened is many of the Pharisees decided, okay, the Old Testament is our rule book, and in the rule book it says you can give a certificate of divorce. Therefore, I can be a godly, obedient Jew and get divorced as much as I want. If I were to commit adultery with another woman, I would be breaking the law. But if I divorce my wife and marry the other woman, now I'm not breaking the law because my rule book tells me that I can get a divorce. Well, one of the very interesting things that Jesus says to them is, haven't you guys read in Genesis where God made them male and female? Where it says that the two shall become one flesh. And then Jesus says, if God has made them one flesh, then who are you to come along and split them up? Well, the striking thing about what my purpose is not to talk about divorce right now, but the striking thing about what Jesus does is, look at what they did. They had a verse. We've got a verse. The verse says, you can give a certificate of divorce. What Jesus responded with is, in essence, saying to them, okay, you may have a verse, but you don't understand God. You don't have His worldview. You don't look at things the way He does. And so you don't understand the place that that verse has in the overall scheme of things. You've forgotten the part in Genesis where it explains how God created us as male and female, and basically explains God's purpose for marriage. Genesis doesn't say anything about divorce. Never mentions the word divorce. But how can I understand what God thinks about divorce if I don't understand what God thinks about marriage? And that's basically what Jesus comes along and says to them. A similar issue happens. The Pharisees were upset with the disciples of Jesus because on the Sabbath, Jews were supposed to refrain from working. And some of the rabbis interpreted work in a fairly strict way. And Jesus' disciples were walking through a wheat field, And they were, as they were walking along, they were picking off the heads of the grain and eating them. And the Pharisees were objecting. They're working. That's not supposed to happen. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And so Jesus comes back at them. And he doesn't say, yeah, but over here I've got a Sabbath verse that says it's okay to pick wheat. He doesn't have such a verse. There isn't such a verse. But what he does have is an understanding of the bigger picture of what it is that God is doing. And he says, haven't you read? And then he starts pointing them to some other passages. He points to them to a passage that says, here's God speaking, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. What does that have to do with anything? It doesn't even mention the Sabbath. It's talking about sacrifice. Sacrifice is different than the Sabbath. There are rules for the sacrifice and there are rules for the Sabbath, and those aren't the same thing. So what is Jesus doing? That's not a Sabbath verse, but it is a Sabbath verse because it gives you a perspective on God and how He ranks various things. What that verse tells me is that God values certain moral qualities over religious ritual. Now, it's not that simple. I mean, the picture of who God is and what He wants is more complicated than that. But that's a part of the picture that the Pharisees had forgotten. Jesus says, don't you remember that time when David took his band of men and they went in and they ate the showbread? And that's against the rules. You're not supposed to do that. And yet they did it. And we hear the story about that, and we don't read about how God struck them dead. Have you ever thought about the fact that you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, but everybody goes to the temple to offer sacrifices and all that stuff? And who is it that's there at the temple taking in all of these sacrifices? Somebody's got to be there cleaning up and taking all of this stuff in and, you know, okay, thanks, we got you. We'll put this over here and we'll burn this over here. Who's doing all that work? Well, the priests are. How come it's okay for the priests to work on the Sabbath if the rules say you just can't work on the Sabbath and that's it? All of this is Jesus' way of saying you guys are grabbing this Sabbath verse and running with it for all it's worth, but you haven't gotten the big picture. You haven't seen what it is that God is all about. Why did He say that? You can't just take a verse and say, okay, it says to do that, so I'm going to do it. Because that's exactly what the Pharisees did, and that's exactly what Jesus objects to. The Pharisees considered themselves obedient because they could defend every single action that they did on the basis of some verse somewhere that would say, see, you're supposed to do this. But Jesus is saying, I don't care if you have a verse, you have no understanding. You don't understand what that verse is doing there. You don't see the bigger picture. So anyway, that's what you and I are called upon to do when we come to the Bible. We're called upon, first of all, to try to understand what is it that it's saying? What is the intent of the author in the passage that we're looking at? And then we're trying to take that and build it into a worldview, a picture of reality that's based not just on a verse that we've pulled out of context, but on a whole biblical understanding. Is this a big job? Yes, this is a big job. But Jesus didn't say to the Pharisees, you know, I know it's a big job. I really understand why it is you haven't a clue as to what's going on here because it's so hard to figure out. His attitude was, why don't you go read it? I mean, that's what he basically keeps saying. Haven't you read this? You guys are passing yourselves off as the teachers of Israel, and you haven't read what it is this says? So, think about the problem. Here, I'm going to give you... I mean, I'm joking, but in a way, I could not be joking in saying this. Here's my life verse. Genesis 22:10. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. I mean, do you see the problem? What are we supposed to do with that? There's a verse in the Bible. Abraham picked up a knife to slay his son. So, So what? I mean, what am I supposed to? What rule am I supposed to follow from a verse like that? What promise am I embracing in with a verse like that? It's just there. It is. Am I supposed to do that? Am I not supposed to do that? I mean, what do I do with a statement like that? Well, when I said I could not be kidding in saying that was my life verse, what I meant was, I'm serious about it, that when you come to understand the significance of that verse in the overall scheme of the story that the Bible is telling, I would say that it is describing, it has to be like in the top 10 of most significant events that ever happened in the history of the world. I mean, forget about the sinking of the Titanic or World War II or any of that kind of stuff. Abraham picked up that knife, I would say, has got to be in the top 10. Jesus dying on the cross, rising from the dead, I will grant you. That probably is ahead of it. But there's not many more. But how do I know that? How would I understand that that's the case? I'm not going to understand that until, first of all, I take that verse and I put it back into the story about how God asks Abraham to offer up Isaac. I have to think about what does it mean that God tested Abraham. I have to back up further and look at the whole life of Abraham to see in the context of Abraham's life, what is it that's being tested? What is it that's at stake? Backing up in that way, then I look at what follows from Abraham's story. I see what it is the New Testament says, because the New Testament has a lot to say about that incident where Abraham offered up Isaac. Ultimately, the very question of the relationship between what we believe and how we live is related to that issue of Abraham's picking up that knife. It's huge. It plays a huge part in biblical theology. But by itself, it does nothing. I mean, that verse isn't going to get you anywhere. You have to put it in the context of Genesis, first of all, but then you have to think about its significance in the light of what the rest of what the Bible has to say. There's no way around it. There is no way around it. I'd like to tell you that there is a shortcut teaching Euclid this year, Euclidean geometry. I was telling the freshmen that, I think I told them this, did I tell you guys? I can't remember if I did or not. That there was a king who was studying geometry with Euclid and asked him basically if, you know, is there some sort of shortcut that we could take here? This seems like kind of a long involved process. And Euclid's answer was, there is no royal road to geometry. Well, that's what I'm saying about the Bible as well. There is no royal road to understanding the Bible. It is a process of reading, thinking, talking to other people, comparing, making mistakes, backing up, rethinking. It's a lifelong process. But there isn't any other way. If you just pick it up and start pointing at things and saying, I'll run with that, then you're just like the Pharisees. And they got themselves in a lot of trouble doing that. They misunderstood what God was about really badly by taking that approach. Okay. I was afraid I wasn't going to have enough to say tonight. We're getting towards the end, and I'm not. But let me make a couple other comments here. I'm going to chop ruthlessly here for a moment. We will... Yes. We'll chop that. What I do want to say something about before we end up is there's one other aspect of this that I want you to understand. We need to talk for a minute about the authority of the Bible. The fact that the Bible says something, the fact that the Bible comes along and tells me something about what Jesus said or what Paul did or what happened to Ezekiel or something like that, what sort of authority does that have for me? Why am I listening to it? We here at the Study Center are at this point very committed to the idea that Everything that the Bible asserts to be true is true. Sometimes people refer to that as inerrancy. The Bible is inerrant, without error in what it asserts. We believe that's true because we believe that's the claim that the Bible makes for itself, and in particular, that is the claim that Jesus makes for the Bible. If we had time, we'd look at John 10, a debate that Jesus gets into with some of the Pharisees, but in making his point, he refers to a psalm and drops the comment while he's saying it, and the scripture cannot be broken. Basically, what he's saying is, this passage over here in the Bible is telling us that this is true. If it's saying that this is true, then I'm telling you it's true. The scripture cannot be broken. You're not going to come back to me and say, well, but that's one of those things that the Bible says to be true that it got wrong. From Jesus' perspective, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't get it wrong. Now, I know that's a controversial claim, and there are an awful lot of people outside the Christian community and even inside the Christian community that don't buy that as a claim. But that's where we're coming from. We understand the Bible to be a unique book because God Himself has been committed through His Spirit to assuring the integrity of what it is the biblical author said. So, don't get this idea the Spirit comes along and is sort of whispering words in their ear and they're writing them down. What we're talking about is the Spirit ensuring that when Paul wrote to the Corinthians saying, this is the gospel, that the gospel that he had in his head was the gospel that was the gospel. What Paul meant to say was true. And it is the Spirit of God that ensured that that was the case. But that's a very important qualification to make, because a lot of the trouble that we get into when we deal with this question of the authority of the Bible arises from not being very good interpreters. What I'm saying is, when we have accurately interpreted what it is the biblical authors meant to say, what they meant to say is right. What they meant to affirm as true is true. I don't know if you've ever had the experience. I've had this experience recently. I don't know why. It's just I'm a glutton for punishment or something. I keep doing it in the hopes that I'm going to find something interesting, and I never do. But I get on the internet and I go looking for skeptical websites for people who are skeptics about the Bible. There are a number of sites out there if you go looking for them. They're kind of little bands of believers. I mean, believers in the idea that Christians are idiots. And they just love, I mean, there's one site, it's called the Skeptic's Bible or something, and it's just go through each book of the Bible and here are all the idiotic and ridiculous things that you find in the Bible one after another. Well, so I go looking at those things sometimes. I'm trying to find something kind of weighty, something with a good argument to kind of have to interact with, you know. And I think I must be looking in the wrong places, but in the places I've been going, I can't find them. The arguments that they make are really bad. And part of what makes them bad is that they pay no attention to what I'm talking about here. I think we in the Christian community often are not very good at reading in context and paying attention to what the biblical authors were actually trying to say. But it's also true of those who are attacking the Bible. They're not any good at reading it in context and figuring out what the biblical authors are trying to say either. When we talk about the authority of the Scriptures, we're talking about the authority of what it is the biblical authors meant to say. When I come to understand Paul's message to the Galatians, then I have understood something true. Until I understand what it is he's trying to say to the Galatians, there's no promise that my misunderstanding of Paul is going to be inerrant. I mean, obviously not. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, so there's so much that we could talk about on this topic. What I wanted to get across tonight is we here at the Study Center take the Bible very seriously. if the Bible is what it presents itself to be, then how can you not take it seriously? This is a record inspired by God of God's encounter with human beings for the purpose of communicating to us what He is doing in the world. It's a story about God coming to a particular man, Abraham, making promises to him concerning his descendants and ultimately all of the families of the earth, all of the nations of the world. A blessing that God is going to bring about through him. And then the story unfolds about his descendants and how they're disobedient to God and how he disciplines them and how he sends prophets to explain to them that a great king is coming who is going to restore everything. And then we come to the New Testament and we find that the arrival of that king is announced. He's this guy from Nazareth. He's a carpenter. He's nobody. Everybody looks at him and thinks, who is this guy? And yet, he makes the claim that he is the king sent from God. He dies, he rises again. He says he is returning to rule forever over all of creation. And he appoints men to speak for him, to give his message in ever more clarity, and to found that group of people that are going to be the followers of the king. Those apostles, those representatives of this king, write letters to those churches telling them, you guys, you're messing up. That's not the way it is. It's like this. And then we come to this book with the history of God's dealing with the Jews, the prophecies of the prophets, the story of the life and teaching of and the death and resurrection of that king, the letters written by his followers. And what we have there is a record of this very rich encounter in which God is telling us, this is what life is about. This is the story. If you don't get the point of this, then you haven't gotten the point of life, because this is what life is about. That's how we see the Bible. The Bible is the fountain of the wisdom that is above all wisdom. It is uniquely authoritative because God has ensured that it is entirely truthful. It has histories, poetry, prophecy, letters, and they are written in normal human language that we can understand if we read them with care. The question is whether we are going to understand it, though. It's not an automatic. Many people do not understand the Bible very well. It takes intellectual integrity. It takes a willingness to back up and say, you know, I may be wrong in what I'm thinking. Every person that I know, that I think of as having some level of maturity and understanding with the Bible, I cannot think of an example of anyone that I know that has some level of understanding of the Bible that has not at some point had to back up and say, you know, what I was taught or what I have been thinking along the line here was wrong. We all come from various traditions, and just the fact of the matter is that there's an awful lot of misunderstanding out there, and all of us have got to wrestle with that to one extent or another. So it takes the kind of integrity and humility to stand before the text and say, you're right, I'm wrong, let's see what we can figure out here. It takes work. If you don't do the work, you will not come to understand. I'm not saying that everyone is called to be a Bible scholar, but the fact is that these are ideas that you have to think about and wrestle with, or they're not going to become yours. It takes skill. Not everyone is going to have equal amounts of skill, but to learn to be a better reader and to a better thinker about what the Bible is saying, there is a level of skill involved. And then finally, most importantly, it takes that personal willingness, that step that says, I personally care about what it is the Bible is saying, am committed to the truth of it, and I am trying to embrace it and live it out. That's what it takes. I would like to believe, in spite of our many imperfections around here. The fact that I have been at McKenzie Study Center so long means that I know where all the skeletons are buried. Is that the expression? I mean, I know a lot about us around here, and I couldn't even begin to argue for the perfection of anything about us. I'm sure that there are things that we've gotten wrong, and I know plenty of things that are not right about us already. But I do think of us as people who have tried as much as we can to have intellectual integrity, to try to work hard. We've tried to develop our skills as readers, and we have tried to be people who are personally embracing and living out what we see in the Bible. That's where we're coming from. So in the weeks to follow, as we're trying to lay out for you what we see is at the core of the biblical message, this is where we're starting. This is what we're about. We are trying to be faithful to understanding the text on its own terms. We, in this class, are not going to be talking to you about a lot of passages in the Bible. You see the time frame that we're working with here. This is not a class in exegesis. We're not going to be explaining the arguments of a lot of passages, although we love to explain the arguments of passages. We're into that around here. But that's not what we're going to be doing in this class. We're trying to back up and talk about the ideas of the Bible and basically say, here's what we see as the thrust of this. We really do invite you. I mean, there's not a single thing that we say that you should believe just because we say it. We're trying to put a picture out there for you and suggest to you, this is the way we think it is. This is the way we think it works. You want to know why we think it's that way? We'll tell you a little bit up here. But if you have questions about it, and you should, then we're glad. Seek us out. Say, well, now, why are you saying that? And ultimately, if it's true, it will be defensible. And we believe in making that defense. Okay, well, boy, I feel crummy. We have a little time here for any questions or comments you might have. I haven't said anything very specific, so I'd understand if you don't have any specific questions at this point, but I invite them if you've got them.
I come from a charismatic background, which I know still affects me. Well, yeah, I would, but anyway. I want to make sure I understand something you're saying. Understanding that the Holy Spirit is there to guide our understanding, is there also a place beyond just looking at a scripture passage totally in context, is there a time, do you believe, when the Spirit will speak to us even out of context, where you don't have to know exactly what the author is trying to get across to you and what he's trying to say, but that the Bible is more is sometimes used in that way also?
Well, let me put it like this. I am not in a position to say that God never does that. Who am I to say? I mean, God can do whatever he wants to do. I know, I have the personal belief that, I mean, this could change. I'm just going on my own experience here. But it seems to me that when I was a young Christian, that God was very patient with me. When I was a young Christian, I used to look for signs in everything. I mean, I would, you know, I'm wondering, what should I do? And I would turn on the radio, you know, what's the next line in the song going to be? You know, and I would take it. There's my message from God, and I would act on it, you know, with some creative thinking, you know, trying to figure out, okay, now where, you know, in a God of Davida, now where do we go, where do we go with that? So, yeah, it did. It got very tricky sometimes. But what I'm saying is, am I saying that God never did anything like that with me back then? No, I don't think so necessarily. I also believe that it's something that I needed to grow out of. I mean, that it was presumptuous of me ultimately to go around thinking that God was going to guide me by giving me messages out of radio, the lines in radio songs. What I do know about the kind of approach that you're describing, I know many people do it, but I know this about it. When I go looking for the objective meaning of the text, that is what it is the author meant to say in the context, then the Bible can speak with authority. Paul talks about the scriptures being profitable for teaching and training and reproof and so on. Well, the reason it's profitable is because you and I can go and look at it and read it together, and we can agree together, this is what it's saying. And thus, oh, okay, if that's what it's saying, then I've been wrong. You can reprove me, you can teach me here something I didn't know, because we agree together that this is what it's saying. The approach where I pull the message out of the text, out of the context, and I'm just saying, for no good reason except it seems to me that it's so, I think that this verse is a message from God that is telling me to do something. What I cannot claim for that is that it has any sort of objective authority. I can't say the Bible said, because the Bible didn't say that. I mean, that's not what it said by any reasonable understanding of what we would mean by saying something. It didn't say that. Maybe God got my attention and by putting something in my mind in a text by a verse that was not what the verse meant. Can I say that he won't do that? No. But it is not the authoritative and objective meaning of the text. I had better be prepared to back off and say, if things don't work out, I'm not going to blame God for having led me astray, because he didn't. Because there was no reason, there's no objective reason to think that that text had this message. I just decided that it had that message. I decided that this is a message from God. Can I decide that wrong? It seems to me that I could decide that wrong. That I could very easily, many, many, many people have gone off the deep end and done all kinds of crazy things because they thought they got a message in the verses of the Bible. So am I exempt from that? I don't know why I would be. So I need to be prepared for the fact that maybe I'm just misunderstanding things in doing that. And finally, I would say, I ought to use the Bible itself as my model if I want to look at what does following God look like, and what is it that the apostles, when Paul's writing to the churches, what is it that he wants of them? I would say that I have no evidence in the Bible that the apostles wanted people to read their letters and get extra messages out of them. In fact, we see just the opposite. Paul wrote an earlier letter that we don't have to the Corinthians, and then in the letter that we do have to the Corinthians, he said, you know, when I wrote that to you, I didn't mean that. You guys misunderstood it. That's not what I meant. I didn't mean that. I meant this. So Paul has a very clear idea in his mind that there is an intent in his words, and that if you get something different from the words than what he meant, you got it wrong. So when you put all of that stuff together, I would say, I don't think that the Bible anywhere encourages us to take that sort of approach. And if I'm going to proceed that way, I ought to proceed at least with caution, because it'd be very easy to convince myself of things that don't really have any basis, I think. So I think it's potentially dangerous. So I think we'll stop.